Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
In 2016, archaeologist Rebecca Yamin was supervising a construction site in the historic district of Philadelphia to make sure no valuable artifacts were underneath or being destroyed, and she came across the remains of a privy. In colonial times, long before cities had trash pickup, people tossed lots of stuff down the outhouse shaft. And she found pottery, a whole bunch of cups and mugs.
We realized, oh my, this is another tavern. A lot of drinking going on in Philadelphia before the Revolutionary War.
The property had belonged to a craftsman, Benjamin Humphreys, and his wife, Mary. And checking historic records revealed that this wasn't an ordinary tavern.
Notice that charges Mrs. Humphreys with running a disorderly house at this address in 1783. Now, a disorderly house was an unlicensed tavern that might have prostitutes hanging around.
And Mrs. Humphreys' punishment?
She be committed to the jail of this city till Saturday week next, and that on the said day she be carted through this city, and that she be afterwards confined in the workhouse at hard labor for 3 months, that she pay the cost of this prosecution.
Jail, getting paraded through town like a pariah, hard labor for 3 months, and a fine? In early America, vice was serious business.
Vice has been a code word for sinful behavior.
Howard Markell is a historian of public health and medicine at the University of Michigan, and he says that sinful behavior...
Frequently that's had to do with sexual behavior, gambling, or the use of substances.
In the past, our concept of vice was based in religion and enforced through laws, but...
As the moral authority of religion began to wane in the 19th century, it becomes more of the authority of science, of medicine, and of course of law.
Rather than judging and punishing people for, quote, sinful behavior, there was a slow push to do something different.
But what has changed, I think, particularly over the last 20 or 30 years in my own career, is an acceptance that these are more health problems than they are legal or moral problems, and that we have to look at that issue first before we throw somebody in jail.
On today's show, we'll explore vice and the role of public health in controlling it. A lot of the so-called vices that public health providers deal with, drug use, smoking, gambling, prostitution, they're still the same behaviors that were shunned by religious communities. And whether you're religious or not, morality, the idea that some actions are good and others are bad, has been an influential driver of public policy. That's certainly true with prostitution. Around the world, there's a growing movement to decriminalize prostitution, but that's a divisive idea stirring passionate debates.
In order to have good health policy, we have to use science.
So where is the science, the data? That's tricky when it comes to prostitution. Yes, it's a multi-billion dollar industry, but in the U.S., it happens underground. That makes it really hard to study.
Except this one part of the country, this one place where the laws of prostitution were totally upended.
That's Ilana Gordon, and we're not talking about brothels in rural Nevada.
Nope, we're talking about Rhode Island. For several years, ending in 2009, indoor prostitution, think spas, online escorts, was not a crime there. The whole thing happened kind of by accident. More on that in a bit. But at the time, it fueled a heated public debate about sex, crime, and health. But then, everyone kind of looked the other way. Well, not everyone.
No, I think more people should be talking about Rhode Island.
It's significant.
You actually see these improvements.
You see the silencing of victims.
So the story really begins in the 70s. The era of disco, tie-dye, and free love. And in Rhode Island, an uptick in prostitution, especially in the state's capital. Lawmakers wanted to speed up the conviction process by making sex work a misdemeanor instead of a felony. And in a complicated rewrite of the prostitution statute, they narrowed the definition of prostitution itself to just street workers, the primary focus of community complaints. Most people didn't really take notice, even judges and police, for decades. Fast forward to the early 2000s. Michael Kisalika, an unassuming civil attorney, got an unexpected request one day.
And in walked a lady and she said, "My friends are in trouble. My friends are in trouble. Please go help them right now."
Michael normally doesn't do criminal defense.
Well, I handle plaintiffs' personal injury cases. I handle legal malpractice cases on behalf of plaintiffs. And I do some insurance defense work.
But he listened to the panicked woman, whose friends, he says, had been working in a house on a main drive in Providence. Police had arrested them for engaging in prostitution. Michael took the case, but not having done much criminal defense.
I said, "Gee, I really ought to know the area of law I'm going to be practicing in," so I read the law.
There's something to be said for having fresh eyes, because Michael noticed something that for years other criminal defense lawyers hadn't, that the statute didn't specify anything about indoor prostitution.
I took a brand new look at it, I guess you could say. And it became apparent to me pretty quickly that the statute didn't line up with what the girls had been charged with doing.
Soon, word got out that he was winning these cases, and more women came to him.
Yeah, the turning point was when the mayor of Providence, he got word of the fact that the police were making these raids, but that the judges were dismissing my cases based on arguments that I was making that he didn't think were correct.
In 2003, the city went to trial with Michael and his legal defense on this issue. The hope was to squash it and clarify once and for all whether this type of activity was criminal. But
the judge ruled, like I argued, that as long as it was two consenting adults, it didn't matter what they agreed to, as long as they did it in private, and it could certainly involve anything, including money.
This became referred to as the loophole. And with that, the alternative newspaper's advertising section exploded with ads for things like body rubs and table showers. Rhode Island, home to a little under a million people, gained a pretty big reputation for its now legal sex industry. And you come from Rhode Island.
I can go there and be free and not worry, finally.
This is Bella Robinson. She says when she learned indoor prostitution was decriminalized in Rhode Island, she packed up her stuff and moved there from New Jersey. Bella is an online escort and says in this line of work, anything could go bad at any time. That's the reality. But in Rhode Island, she felt safer.
If someone tried to rape, rob, or assault me, I can report it. I can tell on you.
And were there situations where you wanted to do that before but couldn't?
Oh, absolutely.
It was 2009. She stayed in a hotel for a while. Business was great. Money was great.
I have seen over 1,680 clients since I moved to Rhode Island.
She had clients who travel in from other states, knowing that it wasn't a crime there.
The extent of the prostitution became almost pervasive.
That's Thomas Verdi, the deputy police chief in Providence. He says beyond an explosion in internet ads, the number of Asian massage parlors involved in prostitution in the city went from just a handful to more than 20.
Law enforcement was handcuffed and it allowed them to operate with relatively ease. And because we lacked the indoor prostitution law, and they knew it, it just flourished.
A movement began to get rid of the loophole in the law and once again criminalize all sex work.
I felt that it was very important to stop the movement to decriminalize prostitution in the United States.
That's Donna Hughes, a sociologist at the University of Rhode Island. She says she doesn't support criminalizing women for this, and that originally she was open-minded about the Rhode Island loophole. But she says when she started researching the consequences of that loophole, she changed her mind. She worried that Rhode Island would become ground zero for decriminalization across the country.
It's just very harmful to women. It really is a very libertarian approach, but the ones who get freedom are the pimps, the sex buyers, the businessmen who then can rent properties to the massage parlors and to the sex buyers. There's very little freedom for the women.
Donna also worried that decriminalization fueled sex trafficking, kidnapping usually young women and forcing them into prostitution. Providence Deputy Police Chief Tom Verdi was also concerned about that.
The police were powerless at the time.
He says some of the spas were hiding trafficking and other organized crime. He says many of these spas were staffed by Asian immigrants.
They'd spend anywhere from 3 to 5 weeks, sometimes a little longer, before someone else from the organization would pick them up and then take them to another city, whether it be New York, Philly was involved, Chicago.
The debate over whether to recriminalize prostitution divided Rhode Island residents, law enforcement, social workers, and even feminists. Passions ran high, but ultimately, the push to recriminalize won out.
Prostitution in outdoors or indoors is a bad thing.
Speaking to NPR, Governor Don Carcheri explained why he signed the law to get rid of the Rhode Island loophole on November 3rd, 2009.
I think it's been a black eye, frankly, in our state that we've allowed this to go on, whatever the reason is, for far too long.
The lawyer who found the original loophole, Michael Kisalika, was dumbfounded.
One day you're a criminal, the next day they flip a switch and the law changes and you're not a criminal, and then 6 years later they flip the switch back again and you become a criminal again. It is a little crazy.
Most of the massage parlors shut down. As for Bella, the online escort who moved to Rhode Island, she was angry.
It pissed me off. I didn't know anything about activism. I didn't even know what a sex worker rights organization was.
Bella changed that. She became active with Coyote, a sex worker union and advocacy group.
So criminalization is a punishment for women who won't conform. And we're just supposed to go live in the streets in poverty and not complain about it and be good women.
And she gained an unlikely ally of sorts, 2,500 miles away.
I think for me, the biggest takeaway is that decriminalization really does improve public health outcomes.
Manisha Shah is a researcher at the University of California, Los Angeles. She studies the worldwide economics of prostitution. For her, the Rhode Island experience was pure gold.
I was excited. I'm like, oh my God, we can do really, really great research from this natural experiment.
When else does a social science researcher get a real-life case study like this, especially on prostitution, which is so hard to study? So what did you find? The obvious, sex work exploded. And the not so obvious, gonorrhea rates dropped during this loophole. A lot.
Around 40%.
40%?
Yes. Yes.
So that's not just like a fluke.
We don't think so. I mean, we spend a lot of time beating up on all of the data and estimating these things in different ways, and we just can't get the results to go away.
A 40% drop is a big deal in the world of public health. Manisha thinks one of the reasons for this positive outcome is that legalization empowered sex workers to say no to riskier sexual behavior. Still, perhaps even more surprising than that decrease in gonorrhea was another public health development. Sexual violence, rapes, dipped dramatically. And not just amongst sex workers. It was across the board.
Reported rape offenses decreased by about 30%.
That's another big decrease. She says, if anything, you'd expect rape to go up, as when prostitution is decriminalized, sex workers are more likely to report rapes. She examined other crime data, like burglaries, murders, to try to discount for this sharp drop. But it didn't match. So what happened? That, she says, is harder to answer. But she has a theory. She says while she knows for some men, rape is about power.
I think the argument that we're making is that that might not be true for all men.
In other words, for some men, maybe rape is just about sex. And if there's a legal and accessible market for it, the number of rapes in a community will go down. This has not been a popular theory, because for many, this challenges the notion that rape is about violence and power, not sex.
So I consider myself a feminist, but I think this finding angers a lot of feminists, and it is a very controversial idea.
And then there's that other controversial idea. Do you worry that decriminalization could also fuel sex trafficking?
I mean, I definitely worry about that. It's an area that I would love to be able to do more with.
But she believes there's no solid evidence yet that decriminalizing prostitution does lead to an increase in trafficking women and forcing them into prostitution. She's more concerned with something else.
The thing I worry about, though, is the conflation of human trafficking and sex work. Because I think there is a huge segment of the sex work population that is making the decision to do this type of work.
The sex market and this type of work hasn't gone away in Rhode Island.
I have a lot of regular clients. I rarely have to advertise anymore.
Bella, the online escort who moved to the state and is now a sex worker activist with Coyote, says the oldest profession has just gone back underground or moved to other corners of the internet. A research project at Rhode Island's Brown University is trying to connect with those sex workers to learn about their experiences since indoor prostitution was recriminalized. Bella is helping.
We interviewed 62 Rhode Island sex workers on their real lives and experiences. And I didn't post the link anywhere. I actually called them and emailed all the escort ads.
The hope is to glean even more insight from this brief experimentation with legal prostitution in this small New England state. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon. Kentucky.
Ain't the country lucky? New Jersey gives us glue. And you come from Rhode Island, and little old Rhode Island is famous for you.
Let's say we had a ton of research on what happens when you decriminalize prostitution, and let's say every last bit of that research found that it was all around beneficial for society to do so. You would still have a really hard time pushing that through because people have very strong feelings about selling your body for sex. So why do we judge? Why do we attempt to curb certain things and not others? Here is public health historian and physician Howard Markell.
Well, you're asking the wrong guy because I'm not a proponent of judging other people and saying this is your vice, but my vice is okay. They're very hard to erase these things from our collective psyche. The desire or the need to judge other people is a decidedly human behavior and a problematic one at best. Things change very slowly, and if for not just decades, but for centuries, you've been taught X is wrong, but Y is right. Those things become embedded in our culture, in our beliefs, whether we acknowledge it's a religious belief or a cultural or a moral or an ethical belief. And it's hard for people to even question those, saying, why do I think this is wrong?
So where does health come into the picture? Maybe let's start by talking about how are health and morals intertwined, or our concept of health?
Very deeply, and it's very hard to untangle that helix of morality and health. You know, a lot of public health, when it emerged in the mid to late 19th century, was very much intertwined with various religious denominations. And a lot of people who were proponents of protecting the public's health were very much involved in their church or their synagogue or their mosque. So a lot of laws that were developed, a lot of public health laws that were developed, were based on the morality issues of, say, prostitution or homosexuality or the spreading of disease and the use of so-called illicit substances. But it's really only begins in the 20th century that these laws are put on the books and public health authorities are charged with prosecuting them. Late 1890s, but it's a 20th century phenomenon largely.
Public health often finds itself at an uncomfortable intersection, for example, with harm reduction, where maybe mm-hmm. you offer people a place. Safe injection sites are a big topic mm-hmm. right now. So you offer people a safe place, quote, to engage in a behavior that most of society thinks of as a terrible behavior.
Harm reduction is a relatively new concept. There's no question. I don't think a physician in the world, certainly not this one, would say that injecting heroin into your veins is a healthy behavior. That said, if you are an addict and you are not ready to quit or go into rehab or what have you, do we want to complicate that problem? Do we want to add to that problem by creating a situation because you're underground to use dirty needles, which will spread hepatitis C, which will spread HIV, and other terrible infectious diseases that, in fact, will not only harm you as the addict, but will harm the entire public health system and the hospital system because we as a society are going to take care of you?
Public health is hopefully based in science, but do you think public health people spend enough time just thinking about what are the moral or ideological underpinnings that I'm working on, the base that I'm standing on when I'm thinking about this?
Absolutely. Are we stigmatizing this person because of this practice or this protocol? And there is a great deal of time, energy, and research spent discussing these issues. And I can tell you, when I look at epidemics past, I don't see historians or bioethicists at the table. Now, people like me are always at the table talking about this or that protocol and looking into the potential for stigma.
So public health people are not a sort of Puritan, modern-day vice squad. They're
well.
To take the fun out of my life.
Take the fun out of your life. No, we have parents for that. No. I mean, look, they're not a monolithic group of people. There's hundreds of thousands of people in that field. Some may be very moralistic. Some may be very judgmental. But as a group and the way it's taught and the way it's considered, I think things have changed quite a bit since the beginning of the AIDS epidemic. That's not the only driver of this trend, but it was a big part of it. And there used to be a lot of doctors back in the 80s and early 90s who would not see AIDS patients, even after we knew how it was transmitted. But there were still doctors and nurses and so on who did not want to be near an AIDS patient. We've evolved quite a bit since then. So the job of a public health officer is not to take the fun out of your life. The job is to help you live a healthier and longer life and a more productive life. Now, it may seem that taking away your ginormous soda pop is taking the fun out of your life, but I would argue that it's quite the opposite.
Howard Markell is a public health historian and a physician. Right, it's confession time. I was a very heavy smoker for many years. I started when I was 14 years old, and I knew smoking was bad for me. That did not deter me at all. But I do have to say, if cigarettes had cost then what they cost now, I don't think I would have been able to afford my habit. Putting heavy taxes on cigarettes is just one tool in the fight against smoking, but this year the World Health Organization concluded that it's one of the most effective ones. But there are certain communities where cheap cigarettes are still easy to get. Jessica Korkunis grew up in western New York, not far from a Seneca Nation reservation.
When I was a kid, I spent a lot of time with my friend Erin Horton. I haven't seen her or her mom in almost 12 years. But when I went home to report this story, I met up with them.
I told you she was coming.
Look at her. She should have roller skates on, don't you think?
I thought she would have grown by now.
Erin lives 30 miles south of Buffalo with her husband and two kids, about a 10-minute drive from the Cattaraugus Indian Reservation, which belongs to the Seneca tribe. Here's where I should mention that when we were teenagers, back in the early 90s, we thought smoking was cool. We also thought going to the res, as we called it, was cool. It was somewhere we wouldn't get carded, where smokes and gas were cheap. Aaron came along with me to check out some of the gas stations and smoke shops we used to go to, and on the ride over, we tried to remember what cigarettes on the reservation used to cost.
A pack was maybe, what, like $2?
A dollar or two, yeah.
I remember buying, like, American Spirits and thinking they were, like,
healthy. Cigarettes. It said additive-free, but I thought it said addictive-free, and I was like, oh, yes! The hill on the left, and pretty much after you crest the hill, I think we're on the res.
Our first stop was Wolf Run. This place reminds you of a highway truck stop with kitschy trinkets, snacks, gas, and of course, cigarettes, cigars, and chewing tobacco. It looks about the same as it did when I was 17, but with one difference. They no longer carry national brand cigarettes like Camels or Marlboros. Now the stock is all Indian-produced cigarettes.
Hi. What kind of cigarettes do you guys have?
We've got the Sands. These are $3. And then we got these King Mountains here, they're menthols, they taste exactly like a Newport. The Senecas, those are $2.75 and they're not bad, they're actually made on this res.
We picked out one pack of 31 Blues and one premium Senecas.
All right, $5 even.
Okay, so $5 for two packs.
They're premium.
Premium's $2.75.
Back in the car, Aaron and I took a closer look at the cigarettes we just bought. Two packs cost $5. If we'd bought a pack of Camels just outside the reservation, it would cost us $10.31. Why such a big difference? Taxes. There are more than 500 tribes across the country. Each is a sovereign nation, so they set their own rules. For example, the New York State cigarette tax is $4.35 per pack. But smoke shops on Seneca reservations don't add on that extra tax, which keeps prices lower. Our next stop was a smaller gas station called Crossroads, where we met attendant Marianne. She was just sitting down for a smoke break.
Oh, that's a good cigarette. That cough comes from smoking a cigarette. I am smoking a cigarette and relaxing. I'm waiting for a customer so I can go pump gas.
How long have you smoked?
Oh, since I was 11.
How old are you now?
I am in my late 50s.
That's more than four decades of smoking. There's a lot of variation across the country, but as a group, American Indians and Alaska Natives have the highest cigarette smoking rates compared to other racial and ethnic groups in the U.S. That's according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. I wanted to ask Seneca Nation officials about the low tobacco prices and the health costs of smoking among tribe members, but they declined my request for an interview. So I reached out to Christine Rhodes, who leads the American Indian Cancer Foundation. She didn't have information about Seneca Nation policies, but she did say,
"It's not the case that there are cheaper cigarettes in all tribal communities."
The Cancer Foundation is working on control policies around the nation, but tobacco sales are big money for some tribes, and she says readiness to change is different from community to community.
We know that price matters both for young people who are thinking about starting smoking, as well as for people who are addicted to nicotine and want to quit smoking. If cigarettes are cheap, there's less of an incentive to quit.
There is a movement that Christine and others think might decrease rates of smoking. The plan is to help people give up unhealthy habits while holding on to native traditions, and that includes using sacred traditional tobacco. Traditional tobacco is grown and prepared without chemicals, different from the commercial tobacco used in mass-market cigarettes. Native rituals vary. Sometimes tobacco is placed near rocks or worn in a pouch on the body.
My children and I, we will offer our tobacco to Mother Earth, like to the tree or the water, to, you know, be thankful for a new day. Some tribal communities also use tobacco for weddings.
That's Coco Villaluz. She's a community educator for the nonprofit organization Clearway Minnesota, and she says traditional tobacco is offered as a sign of respect. It's often used without burning the plant. Other times it is smoked in a pipe to carry prayers to the creator.
Historically, that is, you know, done through ceremonies.
Coco says the education strategy urges people to reject commercial tobacco and to stop using it for ceremonies and prayers. Her organization also offers people help to quit smoking and advocates for smoke-free areas on Indian lands.
We all want the same mission as everybody else who's working on tobacco, whether it's in tribal communities or non-tribal communities. We want our people to be healthy. We don't want to see any more of our loved ones suffering from commercial tobacco-related illnesses.
Jessica Korkunis reported the story. We're talking about vice today and the role of public health in controlling it or helping people lead healthier lives. How you phrase that, I guess, depends on your point of view. And this is a question we often debate as a society when it comes to things like taxing cigarettes or soda. Is the role of good government to protect its citizens, or is that an overprotective nanny state at work? Maybe government is cashing in on our bad habits. Jeff Steyer runs the Risk Analysis Division at the National Center for Public Policy Research. That's a free market think tank. And he says public health policy should be informed by data and by science, but too often it's influenced by ideology. Give me an example where health and morality and preference get muddied together.
It happens all too often. An example that I've been thinking about lately is we know that cigarette smoking is a top preventable cause of death. And now there are products called e-cigarettes, which Public Health England says are 95% safer than smoking. But now we've got these rules popping up around the country, banning the use of e-cigarettes in public places, even outdoor places. Now, if you don't like the smell of e-cigarettes, that's a legitimate discussion. Maybe we do want to ban it as a society. But from a health perspective, the emerging science is pretty clear. We know cigarette smoking is so deadly because of the combustion of tobacco. And e-cigarettes are an attractive alternative, especially if people understand why and how they are so much less harmful. Then there is a difference between the moral idea that people shouldn't do that behavior versus the public health impact of encouraging people to switch to a less harmful alternative if that's their best option.
So it's a behavior we dislike. We dislike the behavior, and then we're lumping a whole bunch of stuff together because we don't want the behavior.
Exactly. And when you say we don't like a behavior, that usually has either a moralistic or a preference aspect to it. And I think those are all legitimate discussions in society to have, whether it's for morality, if we want to legislate morality, or whether it's because, you know, vaping next to someone at a beach that does put out a smell is inconsiderate and it's rude.
But generally speaking, you do see a role for government in terms of encouraging or rewarding healthy behavior and forbidding unhealthy behavior.
Well, you had me until you said forbidding unhealthy behavior.
I probably didn't word that right. So let me regulating. How about that?
I will say that raising that issue, are we regulating or are we forbidding, actually is a great question because it gets really to the heart of the issue, is we need to regulate these things, especially at a time when your own individual choices affect everybody else, whether it's through increased healthcare costs or whatever it may be. So even I, as a libertarian, recognize that if someone engages in risky behavior, that does impact me. I personally enjoy skiing. If you saw how I skied, you'd recognize that it's risky. Do we want the government to regulate that? Well, if I'm not skiing into other people, maybe not, unless if I get injured and it has some cost to society, maybe. But it gets to those issues, really.
When you say to public health folks, look, this is not a science-based argument, you're making a moral argument, what are their reactions?
They'll often bang on the table. and they'll go back to the precautionary principle. They used to make other arguments. Then they'll make an argument like the gateway argument, which is usually an argument of last resort. And they'll say, well, kids who don't smoke are going to use e-cigarettes, and then they're going to graduate, if you will, to smoking. And now we have more and more evidence that that's not happening. So I think what I would really love for the public health community to understand is that the decisions we make must be based in science and not driven by this ideological opposition to it. Let's give people better choices.
And the intended outcome, I guess, is something we would have to discuss first, too. Is that to have as many healthy citizens as possible? What would be your ideal intended outcome for public health policy?
That again, is a question where different people legitimately have different views. I have heard from people, you know, I'm pretty confident that if I lived the life that public health wanted me to live, I could probably live into my 90s or beyond. But this gentleman said, I don't want to live that life. I want to go skydiving. Not safe. I want to live life to the fullest. So I think that's a legitimate point of view. And for others who want to lead very long lives, I wish them well. But I don't think the public health community, which we as a society give permission to control how we live by banning things, regulating things, taxing things, then those actions must stem from that goal to protect us so we can make informed decisions about whether or not we want to engage in a certain risky behavior.
Jeff Steyer is an analyst with the National Center for Public Policy Research.
Penn Medicine's Heart and Vascular Center supports the Pulse. With community cardiology practices throughout Pennsylvania and New Jersey, Penn's Heart and Vascular Center has made a commitment to deliver advanced treatment options, personalized care, and convenient access close to home. Learn more about Penn's Heart and Vascular Center at pennheart.org or 800-789-PENN. Your life is worth Penn Medicine.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. We're talking about vice on today's show, or what used to be referred to as vice, but now is more commonly framed as health issues. Take gluttony, for example. Who says that anymore? Instead, we talk about food choices, healthy eating, the rainbow on your plate, and so on. Making good nutritional choices is a hot topic with food stamps or SNAP benefits. They are supposed to help low-income people feed their families, but there are limits to what you can buy with them. Emmeline Friedman, a California grad student with a couple of side jobs to make ends meet, has been using these benefits for a couple of months now. She usually shops at a grocery store and cooks at home, but
I actually had a funny snafu at Subway. You know, I was in a hurry one day, didn't want to make a sandwich at home, so I said, hey, I'll stop at Subway and try and use my benefits. And when I got there, I wasn't thinking, and I asked for my sub toasted. And apparently, you can only buy cold food. So I got to the register, and she was like, your card isn't working, I don't know why. And we were trying to figure out what it was. I talked to some friends of mine who are also in the food stamps program, and they said, it can't be toasted. You cannot toast that sub.
That's right. You cannot buy hot food with your SNAP benefits, but you can buy candy, soda, chocolate, and ice cream. Plenty of people argue that doesn't make sense, and they say that with about 43 million Americans using food stamps, this could be an opportunity to encourage better eating habits and to fight the obesity problem. Here's John Whiteman with the advocacy organization The Food Trust. So SNAP, what does it stand for?
Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program.
In your mind, as somebody who's interested in healthy choices, should certain items be restricted as purchases with food stamps?
Our focus has generally been on incentivizing healthier foods. So sometimes it can be more expensive to purchase healthier foods like fresh fruits and vegetables. So at the Food Trust, we've done a lot of work over the years to provide incentives at places like farmers markets. And now at grocery stores, we're also providing an incentive called Food Bucks, which helps incentivize purchase of healthy fruits and vegetables.
So basically, I can buy the soda if I want to, but if I buy the apples, I get more for my money.
Exactly. It's really, in some ways, it's trying to level the playing field. Unfortunately, some of the least healthy foods are also the cheapest, so that makes it tough if you're living on a tight budget.
But a recent study found that soft drinks were the top item bought by food stamp recipients, along with snacks and candy.
The choices that people are making using food stamps are very similar to what the rest of the country are making. So as we all know, it can be there's temptations out there. So it's hard to really choose healthier foods all the time. There's lots of foods out there that are not the most healthy. So that's something that the whole country, I think, is working on. But the good news is that, you know, that people are starting to wise up that, you know, things like soda sales, the trend is that that's going down nationally now because people realize that, you know, that's just too much soda to drink.
New York City tried to limit soft drink sales for everyone. They also wanted to restrict soda bought with food stamps, but the city was not able to push that legislation through. John Weidman is with the Food Trust. As more communities across the United States deal with the opioid epidemic, our thinking on how to best treat people keeps evolving. The South Bronx in New York City has quietly dealt with a heroin crisis for decades. And many of the, quote, hot new ideas that are floating around right now, they've been in practice there for a long time. For example, treating addiction like a chronic disease. Stephanie Daniel is a reporter with the Ground Truth Project, and she sat in on a doctor's appointment.
What's going on? How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing good.
Any problems?
Meet Chinazo Cunningham. She's a primary care physician and runs a family health center in the South Bronx. Dinah is her patient.
And your mammogram?
That I haven't done.
Okay.
Can I do that here?
Yeah, you can do it in the basement. This is a routine checkup with an extra step. Dinah is a recovering heroin user. She takes buprenorphine, a prescription medication to treat addiction and prevent relapse. At this health center, Dinah gets that drug and all of her other medications in the same place.
It is a one-stop shop, and the treatment that I get here is phenomenal.
Dinah is 43. She's chatty with a bright smile. Her brown face is youthful, her black hair weaved into two long braids. She grew up here in the South Bronx.
What about your smoking?
Vape still.
Okay. So that's good.
Dinah asked me to only use her first name for this story. When she was 13, her mom died from cancer. Eventually, she started using cocaine to cope with that loss. Then in her mid-20s, Dinah tried heroin.
Then I started feeling really, really good. I was like, you know, I want to do this again. And so I did.
This was Dinah's life for about a decade. During this time, she was in and out of jail and prison. Not too different from a lot of other people with drug habits. From 2000 to 2010, the number of people in prison for drug offenses grew by more than 30%. As a country, we largely dealt with addiction as a criminal problem. And while drug users have always been mostly white, the rate of incarceration among blacks and Hispanics is much higher.
So in the Bronx, this is not new at all. I mean, this has been going on for decades. Nobody really cared and felt the need to really address this.
Soon, many more people were abusing prescription pills. The epidemic tore through America's heartland, including lots of places outside big cities. As more young, white, and wealthy people got hooked on opioids, the more people began to pay attention to addiction experts like Chinazo Cunningham.
10 years ago, we were all about incarcerating people.
There's been a shift. Since 2010, the number of drug users in prison has declined across the U.S., and courts increasingly send people to treatment programs. The very first drug court opened in the late 80s, and now there are more than 3,000 across the country.
Now we are discussing that addiction is a chronic illness, that addiction is a medical problem, that addiction requires medical treatment.
Addiction experts want to treat opioid dependence like other lifelong conditions, such as heart disease or asthma.
And then your blood pressure?
It's been fine. I mean, I normally...
Researchers found that one of the most effective ways to treat it is with prescription medication, like methadone or buprenorphine. These kind of drugs can reduce withdrawal or cravings and help maintain recovery. But the approach works best when it's paired with counseling and long-term care. Chinazo says her clinic does all of that.
And so patients come to us for their diabetes and their high blood pressure and their addiction and their depression. And we will provide treatment for all of those things. And then if people need specialty care, we might send them to a psychiatrist or to somebody with an addiction specialty.
More than a decade ago, this health clinic was one of the first in the country to integrate addiction treatment with primary care. Even though these anti-addiction medications work very well for many people, most doctors don't want to prescribe them. Right now, only about 3% of primary care doctors nationwide have the required prescribing license from the Drug Enforcement Agency. Chinazo says one of the reasons is stigma.
Some of the barriers that we have heard is that I don't want, quote-unquote, those patients in our waiting room. My response is, quote unquote, those patients are already in your waiting room. They are your colleagues, your patients, your neighbors, your friends, and your family members, because addiction does not discriminate.
Chinazo has worked in this community for 19 years.
Maybe we should start with the patient example. I mean, I also have a
She holds a monthly meeting at her clinic to train doctors, pharmacists, and other healthcare providers on new ways to treat addiction. Today, the conversation is about pregnant women and buprenorphine.
We've had like four separate pregnancies on treatment.
This is just one of lots of new issues that will need to be addressed as more providers start prescribing the drug.
Most doctors haven't had the training in medical school or residency. And so this is a way for providers to feel, you know, when they have cases, when they have questions, that they can go to this meeting and really think about how to best provide treatment.
Over the years, officials have tried many things in an effort to narrow the treatment gap. For example, in 2014, the Affordable Care Act mandated that all insurance companies cover mental health and substance use conditions in the same way they were covering other health problems. And there's now a federal law that allows nurses and physicians' assistants to also be licensed to prescribe opioid addiction medication. Chinazo says it will take more people thinking differently about addiction to curb the epidemic.
It takes a lot of work to change the culture. It's not just the doctors, it's the nurses, it's the front, you know, desk staff, it's everybody throughout the system, it's administrators, to say this is what we do, this is part of the care we provide.
This story comes to us from the Ground Truth Project. You can hear more of Stephanie Daniels' reporting in the latest season of the Ground Truth podcast. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alana Gordon, Irina Zhurov, and Alan Yu. Liz Tung is our intern, and this is her last week with us. We want to thank you so much for all the great work you've done. We had help producing this week's show from Alex Stern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Paige Flager is our associate producer. Tanya English is our managing editor, and Megan Pinto, the executive producer. Today, we talked about how our ideas of good and bad work their way into healthcare. Physician Howard Markel, we heard from him earlier, got some helpful advice on that topic on his first day of med school.
You are here to heal people, to treat people, and hopefully cure them. If you want to judge people, go across the campus and go to law school.
Never miss a moment of The Pulse. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to supporting innovative approaches in integrated health care.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.